Hello, my marketing and entrepreneur friends. Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. I am your host, Katya Allison. So what have you gotten yourself into? Together, we are decoding marketing to make it accessible for everyone. We're cutting through the BS and getting down to the nitty-gritty. In each episode, you will walk away with a nugget or an insight that you can bring into your professional and sometimes even your personal life. So stick around and take a listen to all of the knowledge bombs that are being dropped in every episode. And today is no exception. Today, I am chatting with Brooke Shepherd, someone who truly lives at the intersection of creativity, data, and strategy. Brooke is the founder and the CEO of Mason Interactive, a full-service digital marketing agency known for helping brands from e-commerce disruptors to higher education institutions. They scale through smart, data-driven campaigns, which is what we're talking about, with over a decade of experience and a reputation as a straight-talking strategist. He brings a rare blend of just kind of this hands-on expertise and big picture vision to the marketing table. And in this episode, he brings all of that to us. We dive into what it really means to be data-driven in today's marketing world. I feel like that term gets thrown around a lot, right? We get into the dangers of chasing ROI at the expense of growth. He explains how the halo effect, oh my goodness, the halo effect works across channels like Meta and Google. And he shares how his agency helps clients align on meaningful metrics across their departments, from interns to CEOs. We also dive into a little bit of staying hands-on as a leader, the value of customer acquisition goals, and when intuition does have a place in performance marketing. So if you're ready to challenge some assumptions about efficiency, attribution, and what it means to grow smart, not just fast, stick around. This episode is packed with insights you won't want to miss. So you know the deal. Grab your favorite beverage, sit back, and let's dive into it. Let's talk marketing. Brooke, welcome to the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. Super excited to have you on here and really excited for us to be diving into data-driven marketing, which I know that our listeners are going to be really excited to hear about. So thank you for coming on here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I always like for my audience to get to know the guests a little bit. So I've got my standard questions. They're very easy. So let's get started with that. The first question is, what was your first marketing role? Whether it had marketing in the title or it didn't, what kind of gave you the buzz?
My first marketing role was at CBS MarketWatch, where I worked on it was a TV show. It was in nascent days of the internet. It was at CBS here in New York. And my job was to help market the television program.
Wow, you dove right into like the big dog of marketing, didn't you?
It was really a great education because I didn't go to school for marketing. I wanted to work in advertising. I never knew that I was supposed to do things like have an internship. So it was the closest I could get to an advertising job. And I liked it. And I learned a lot there.
What did you like the most about it? What was kind of thrilling probably sounds like an overdramatic word for it. But what's the part that you liked about it?
The electricity, I wasn't on the nightly news, but Dan Rather was the anchor there. And the electricity of walking past the CBS production facility when they were doing the nightly news with Dan Rather. At the time there were three networks. And to watch just the electricity and the lights and the aggression and the production values of that going on was really nice. Plus, Dan Rather was always very nice to me, and I was a very lowly person. He was always very nice to me in the elevators, and he might not remember my name, but he tried. And it always struck me as like, wow, that's a very powerful guy that shapes narratives in our culture.
Yeah.
And he says hello to me in the elevator. That's cool. I really like that.
That is really cool. And it is a great place to get the education behind how all of, you know, the magic happens and how all of it's connected. Now that's where you started. Where are you at now? What are you doing?
I am the CEO and mostly owner of Mason Interactive, a 35-person digital advertising agency headquartered in New York, where I am now with another office in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Very nice. And what is it that you love about what you do? But be prepared. I'm going to also ask you what you don't like. But let's start with the good. What do you love about what you currently do?
The thing I love most about my job is that it's constantly changing and it's very fast paced. So I really like that what I'm doing now is not the same thing I was doing 6 months ago or a year ago. And the corollary to that, which sounds cheesy, but it's not, is I really like bringing young colleagues along and teaching them, if I'm able to, and we can get this done, educating them and coaching them on how to be successful in their careers. I hope it's here, they might go somewhere else, but coaching them through, like, this is how to deal with problems that come your way. This is the decision matrix we should face. This is how to go through it. And I really enjoyed that too. And you can see someone who comes out of school and is filled with vigor and pep, and 3 years later, they're managing a $1 million marketing budget and they're doing it with panache. That's very gratifying. Yeah.
Well, you were a piece of helping them in that too. I think there's some sort of magic when it comes to it, when like the lights turn on to something that can be not be daunting, but I think marketing can sound more complicated than it is, depending on who you're talking to. I think people that are filled with really big egos tend to use like the big boisterous words and like, I don't know, then people kind of glaze over, they have this glazed look over their eyes. So when you can bring like that magic to them and share what it is that you like about it, I think that's amazing. So that's what you love. If I had a wand and I could remove something, what would that be?
Yeah, I really don't like negotiating rents. I mean, I really like most of my job, but there's a lot of like homework pieces as the CEO.
Yeah,
but we're not so big that I can have like hundreds of administrators, but we're big enough that we have like leases to negotiate, and I could deal with that with some of that homework, the stuff that doesn't relate to advertising and doesn't relate to elevating colleagues. I could do without that stuff.
Yeah, it's all the admin-y stuff or logistics talk, if you will. Now, being in marketing, especially digital marketing, there's a lot of things that are just kind of going on that you kind of have to have your finger on the pulse. So how do you keep your finger on the pulse of things? Is it through social? Is there a newsletter? Do you follow podcasts? Is there a book that you're like, I always go to? How are you keeping your fingers on the pulse?
Well, having a 16-year-old son helps, honestly. And a wife is a high school principal, so she's subjected or exposed to a lot of new ideas and lingo too. So that helps. And working with the staff, I'm 49. A lot of the staff are in their 20s. That helps too. I consume a lot of news. I try to read a lot of things on the right and the left. I try to read The Economist each week, the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And there's a bunch of podcasts I listen to for cultural exposure. But mostly I feel like if I read the front page of those two newspapers and The Economist each week, I'm going to have a pretty decent sense of what's happening in the world. And usually they'll have things about the specific industry that I'm in. But plenty of newsletters. I consume a lot of news.
So you consume a lot of news to keep your fingers on the pulse of things that are going on. What would you say is most helpful for you to keep your fingers on the pulse from a digital marketing perspective to help you kind of navigate either strategies or just kind of the way that you're looking at campaigns?
Well, I'm in the middle of it all day long. So I can't, mm-hmm. you know, we're not so big that I'm not talking to clients. So I'm in the middle of it all day long. Mm-hmm. On top of that, I actually still run one or two small accounts here so I can keep my hands dirty and understand the specifics. And so like on a very tactical level, I need to have some idea of what it is I'm talking about with a different kind of campaign, demand gen campaigns in Google. I need to know what those are. So I run them myself, but really just surrounding yourself. I'm a big advocate for in-office. At least partially. We're 2 days a week in the office. I'd like to do more. I think some of the staff would like to do less. But just being around other people and having conversations is a huge part of it.
Yeah, that's how you spark creativity for sure in like those types of things. I also think it's pretty unique that you, as a CEO, are still running small or big, just the fact that you're getting your hands dirty. Do you find it to be unique as well, too, as you speak to other people from other agencies or other leaders in other agencies?
No, not in my space. I was actually, that's a great question, but I was actually reluctant to do it for a long time. But I felt like I needed to. I think most people in my position that run digital marketing and digital advertising agencies have to be a little hands-on. It just changes so quickly. I mean, it's like, how do we stay up to date? Like, an anecdote about that is, so one debate clients will have is in-house versus agency.
And we don't lose
all the time. Knock on wood, now that I say this, it's going to happen tomorrow. But we don't lose a lot of clients to in-house. No, I mean, knock on wood, it could all fall apart tomorrow. But that's not generally what happens. It has happened. It does happen. It's not generally what happens. But one of the dangers of that is the skills in the platforms change so quickly that your skills can be out of date in 6 months. And you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know that your skills are out of date in 6 months unless you were subjected to sitting in a room with 20 or 30 other people who are saying, did you just have no more response from that tactic? And it's actually a big thing. One of the things in our industry, and I've listened to your show before, and I've heard people talk about things around this, is the concept specifically in digital advertising, is around the concept of audiences, which were the most important thing 7 years ago. And they're still important, but they're no longer the most important thing. And so you'll get people that are not up to date on the client side, and they'll say, well, I want to target men who are 39 to 49 differently than 29 to 39, and people who live in Boston differently than New York. And that doesn't really work that way anymore. And so it's like it's part of it. It's not the biggest part of it. So it's really crucial to stay up to date and to have some keep your hands a little dirty, I found, so you can be able to, frankly, to push back on clients and say, actually, the newest learnings that we see across our 60 clients and our $20 million to spend a month is this.
I think sometimes the challenge that I find in working with agencies is not like, there is a bit of this, can we do this in-house or do we need to outsource it to an agency, is the amount of overhead that the agency has and then the layers that you have to be able to, between you and the agency, to be able to pivot quickly. Because I feel like nobody knows my business like I know my business. And agencies have like full staff and sometimes they bring like everybody to a meeting, but you want to still be able to be nimble. How do you guys balance, you know, having a team for one of your clients, but also ensuring that you guys are nimble enough to be able to make those changes? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, no, it's a super valid question. The first thing is that we are slightly more expensive than doing it on your own.
Yeah.
We are not a lot more expensive. If we were a lot more expensive, we would go out of business. And I don't know that the overhead is necessarily the issue. Like, I think about this, like, if you hire an agency, you don't need to pay into the 401k, you don't need to pay into unemployment insurance, you don't need to get them a new computer, you know, and agencies have to be light in their feet because they're always the first to go if there's a problem. So we don't operate at a huge profit margin, and you can see this in the public filings for the holdcos that are much bigger than I am. There's not a huge savings to bring in-house. It's really not a big percentage point that we're operating on. Because again, if we were, our processes, our technology, our ideas, our staff, our history, we can charge a little more than doing it in-house. We can't charge a lot more, or you would just do it in-house. So I don't think, I know that sounds self-serving coming from like a guy who owns an agency, but that's sort of my perspective on it. But the question around being nimble is really important. And you're right about the layers. Ultimately, I think it's about having a process that your staff can follow. So like, you know, a client that pays us $200,000 a month is going to get a different level of service than a client who pays us $2,000 a month. But hopefully, both of those constructs, there's going to be different levels of people on those accounts. But hopefully, the constructs and the ideas and the processes that they're following at each level are the same and are standardized across the agency and allow them to get propagated out. But I do worry about it. We're 35 people. I do worry about it. If we're 100 people, like, are we going to lose? like we're in a Goldilocks zone right now. We're small.
Yeah.
We're big enough to have a creative team and an SEO team and an email team and two or three media team. Like we have all these teams, but we're small enough that you can probably almost always get the CEO on the phone. And I do wonder what'll happen if we go to 100 people. Like, how's that going to work? So I'll learn about that as I get there.
I think that's always the challenge of growth. You want to grow as a business, but there is that the bigger that you get, the more removed you get. So I love the fact that you do still roll up your sleeves and get into that, and that, you know, you're keeping it quote unquote in-house, in a way that the process benefits your customers as well too. Now I'm ready to talk about marketing in a totally different way. What I'd like to dive into is data-driven marketing. And I love this because I call myself a data dork. I want to get almost a little bit basic and granular. So data-driven, I feel like, is kind of this term that's a little overused. And then I've also heard data-informed. But what does even data-driven marketing decisions mean?
Yeah, that's a big one. I appreciate that. It's a big one. So my preamble to that is, and I said this to a client an hour ago, our job is not to do what the client asks tells us to. Our job is to give our best advice and then do what the client asks us to do, right? So, and we don't always have to agree. If we're always agreeing, like you don't need us. We're not supposed to always agree.
Yeah.
So we're supposed to give different ideas. And so the truth is that data means different things to different people. What's happened in the last couple of years, and I'm not alone in saying this, is that it correlates to interest rates. I'm not sure it's caused by interest rates, but it correlates to interest rates going up. And in the ecosystem across our clients, and not everyone, but generally, there's a move to say, I want to be efficient. Mm-hmm. And what they mean by efficient generally is ROAS, return on ad spend, or ROI, return on investment, or CAC, customer acquisition cost, or CPL, cost per lead. Like they generally mean some version of like spend the least to get the most. And the way that the problem with that, if you're looking just at that data and you're not looking at the bigger picture, is anyone in my position is going to say that the right way, this is not a unique opinion I have here. The fastest way to get someone the best return on investment, ROI, CAC, CPL, is to focus on selling to existing customers again. And that's harder if you sell BMWs, and it's easier if you sell hair ties, right? Like it's just one of those costs a lot, one of them doesn't cost a lot. But if you focus exclusively on the highest ROI, which means you're focusing by definition on extracting the most value for the least money, you're gonna be focusing on existing customers. And what that means is eventually you're going to have no new customers and you're going to be in a death spiral. You're going to be so efficient that you're going to efficient yourself right out of business. And it's like, I say that not glibly, like it happens. So when you're looking at the data, I think another way to do it, and it's our job to talk to clients about this, is to say, listen, I'm not being inefficient. I'm totally with you. You told us you need to have a $50 cost per order, $500 or $5, just 50, it's easy. You told us you needed a $50 cost per order, and we're at 49, and that's great. But let's look at this other campaign over here that has a $200 cost per acquisition. I don't think that's bad, that campaign in this example. It could be bad, but in this example, it's a good campaign because it's driving new users into the funnel. Its goal is not to get the lowest, most efficient return on investment. Its goal is to get new customers so you can get that return on investment later. And it matters. You can't be out of whack for your business. It matters, but let's look at it in an aggregated way. And let's have line items in our conversations about the data. Let's have a full picture of the data, and let's talk about the ROI and the CAC and the CPL. Let's also talk about how many new customers did you get this month? Is that more or fewer? Is that fewer or more than you got last year at the same time? Like really taking a look at all the data across all the channels and lumping it together and having a holistic picture of it is the way we like to do it and try to advise our clients to do it. So I think that's a long-winded answer of saying every client gets to define what data they want to look at. And it's our job to say, well, hold on, we have $1 billion in ads managed. Here's the way we look at it. And ultimately, we'll do what you want. But here's the way we look at it. And here's what we see across the clients that have grown from $0 to $50 million. Here's the way they looked at it.
I'm obsessed with what you're saying because I don't think that we actually talk about that enough. There's more when we talk about, or when I have conversations about data-driven marketing, there's this focus on all of the metrics that we're looking in. What's the story that it tells? And you're absolutely right. All of this tells a story. But one thing that I want to point out that you said that is so key is that new versus existing. They have different numbers. So it's not a one size fits all for anything. And it does depend on the business as well too. Maybe you don't have to worry about the lowest return on investment because you don't have enough net new customers. Because the lifetime value of one new customer, you may need to invest, I mean, dare I say even like $1,000, because there are businesses where like that is a good return on investment
100%.
Because they stay with you for so long and then they continue to purchase. So I really love that you've broken it down in that way.
Thank you. Well, part of it is the business. So I didn't say this, but like, of our 60-ish clients, about half of our clients are schools. And about half of our clients are what we call emerging direct-to-consumer brands. They lean fashion. They lean fashion, but because I like fashion and I like schools. Education is a great levelizing force in our society. I hope it continues to be. What's interesting there in the dichotomy, and I will die on the hill of this being a value for our clients, is generally speaking, the e-com brands are generally more sophisticated about deploying creative rapidly. Even if you're a luxury brand where the brand standards are impeccably high, they're generally better at having the velocity of creative that moves the needle. The schools are more hidebound. But what the schools do much better than the D2C brands, the direct-to-consumer brands, the e-com brands, the schools have to get new customers. Do some people get multiple degrees? They do, but it's not the majority. Most people go to school, they go for undergrad, master's, and that's it. And so they have to always get new customers. And they're okay spending, you mentioned $1,000. They're okay spending that or 10 times that or somewhere less than that to get new customers. And I do wish that I try to make our two client bases learn from one another. Say, hey, direct-to-consumer e-com brands, you really got to focus on new customers because check out what these schools are doing. If they weren't getting new customers, they'd be dead. Hey, schools, maybe we can talk about the learnings from the velocity of the creative deployment of this shoe brand, and we can talk about what to learn from them and trying to stitch those things together.
Well, I would imagine that's got to be a challenging conversation to have in general, because I think anytime I talk about like marketing data, again, there's the glazed look in someone's eyes where you really sometimes, and hopefully this doesn't come off, I don't know, callous, but sometimes you have to break it down to like the lowest denominator in order for people to like completely understand what do these numbers mean and why you should look at, you know, what another brand is doing or another industry is doing. It sounds like you're still having those conversations, but any advice on like how you're delivering kind of the value of the data to the people that you're speaking to?
Oh, repeating it. Yeah, you have to say it many times is the answer.
In many different ways?
I try to do it in one way. I try to do it in one way. I try to be consistent and repeat it. There's you mentioned do I listen to podcasts? There's one podcast in The Economist called Bosscast, I think it's called. And they're always interviewing CEOs who are much more successful than I am. These are Fortune 500 companies. And they're all talking about like repetition. Repeat it, say it again. And I try to take that to heart because we have a data engineer team here at Mason and we can put the data together for clients, but you just need to keep repeating it to make sure everyone's in the same. You need to make sure you have a data set that the CEO, the VP, the director, and the intern can all understand and agree on what is happening. And that's challenging. That's the job.
You so naturally lean into like the segues that I want to go into because you talk about the different people that you do need to deliver the data to, right? Like when I look at my data, when I'm talking to my team, we take a look at a lot more numbers and we talk holistically, what's the story that is telling them, right? But what we deliver for, you know, a monthly business review is like four numbers versus all of these different numbers, right? And then there's the next level to the sales team. Like, have you found kind of the sweet spot of at these different levels, CEO to marketing, like what are the metrics that are most important? Or you're probably going to say it depends, but I'm kind of curious.
No, I think it's revenue most of all. I think the biggest thing for me is like most people care about revenue, whether that means new students or so. And most people are willing to listen. We've recently hired a data scientist to look at some of the from Columbia University, a tenured statistics professor, to help us look at the data. And I'll give you an example of how to look through this. We have a client who I'm trying to figure out how to disguise them while still being useful. We have a client; it's a school, and they run ads on Google and Instagram. It's a lot more than that, but let's just boil it down to that. Okay. And let's pretend the cost per lead on Google is $10, which they love, and the cost per lead on Meta is $50, which they don't love. Those aren't the numbers, but let's just paint that picture. So the CFO, the CEO and the CFO are having coffee together, right? They're still in the office, and they're having coffee together, and they're taking a look at this, and they're saying, wow, marketing, what are they doing? Why do we have all this spend on this Instagram that's getting, I mean, did they not understand marketing? It's a $50 cost per lead versus a $10 cost per lead. We got to turn it off. If it's a CFO way of looking at it. And I get it. I have to be the CFO of my company sometimes. And so what we've been able to do is to through a series of discussions, is to articulate our position that we should be judging those two things by different metrics. But you can't search for something on Google if you don't know what it is. It's a logical impossibility to Google something if you don't know what it is. You can't do it.
Yeah.
I guess you could randomly type in letters and find something, but that's not how it works. So then you need to ask people, well, the CFO, like, well, how do you think they Googled you? Like, do you think they found you on Instagram maybe? You don't want to say it like that, but like that's the way of thinking about it, right? And so what we've been able to do, leading the witness, we call it inceptioning them. Yes, leading the witness. And so what you do, so we've done this data scientist, the statistics professor, is be able to assign a very clear value for this specific client to Meta ads and their impact on other channels. So it's true, and this I'm not using the straight numbers, but it's true that Meta does not have the same cost per lead as Google for this client. It's I'm saying it's 50 versus 10. It's not, it's closer than that. But it's true that that's the case. But also, every time we spend dollars on Meta, your organic traffic does better. And when we spend less on Meta, your organic traffic does worse. And we can quantify this with statistically valid results. To the point where we know that Meta traffic is not just worth the leads of $50 a lead, it's also worth an extra 0.25, 25% organic lift. And what we further can see in this specific client is that, sure, $50 a lead versus Google's 10. But Google's conversion rate and Google's click-through rate do better in 2 months for every dollar you spend on Meta versus when you turn it off. So it has a downstream effect, right? And so we have all the data and we have all the graphs and we can show that. That is not the conversation I would have with the CEO. The conversation I would have with the CEO is, hey, good news. The project we talked about is working. I want to boil it down. Spend more on Meta, get more organic. Spend more on Meta, do better Google. Right, like it's the same data, but like it's just some people want to look at the correlations and the graphs and the math, and some people want to be told this is how it is, and both are valid ways to do it.
No, absolutely. I think the halo effect is one of the biggest challenges for myself to be able to articulate to everybody, and like a big part of that is, you know, a current challenge is, you know, lead generation. That's something that's very quantifiable. I can tell you exactly how many leads, I can tell you where they came from, and then I can look at all of the numbers as far as like how long it takes for them to convert from one stage to the next. Brand awareness to me is something that almost feeds into like that halo effect, kind of what it is that you're already talking about, like what you do with Meta is going to help you with Google. So from a brand awareness perspective, I mean, I don't have a data scientist. What are your recommendations to be able to show that?
That's a fantastic question, because the truth is you can dump a huge data set into Claude, or if you're using Salesforce or Slate or HubSpot or something. Those are all mostly last touch attribution models, which have their own issue. But you can dump those into Claude and now ChatGPT, and you can get an answer. And I can tell you those answers, having been doing this for a long time. What I've found from a messaging perspective is that when the CEO of the advertising agency says to you something about P graphs and correlations and statistical validity, it doesn't resonate as well as when the statistics professor is saying it. And so a lot of it is just about the message. So they're not, the statistics professor and I, she sometimes corrects me and points out flaws in my logic, which I appreciate. But generally, we're seeing the same thing, because the truth is she can do the math in her head. I can't. I went to art school, not statistics school. So I can't do the math in my head, and I have to rely on AI for that. But the truth is, leveraging them together, or leveraging the power of the data that you can use for the AI, and then in my case, and this might not be helpful to you, but in our case, what we found helpful is, here's an independent third party that's affiliated with a prestigious university, and they're not putting their rubber stamp on garbage. Like, this is what they say. And look, they don't even agree with me all the time. They mostly agree with me. They've got a few places they think I'm wrong, but that, and that adds validity to it. So that's the way we're trying to do it. But, you know, not everyone wants to hear that either, right? Some people are like, there's still a lot of people who are like, my ROI was down. 30 minutes ago, my ROI was down. Why? I don't know.
It's also the constant like refreshing button as well too. Like, it doesn't, if it happened overnight, everybody would do it. And there would be like, it just, if it happened overnight, everybody would do the same thing. And then it honestly would lose its effectiveness anyways, but the constant refresh and the why, and let's get more and let's do it faster, I think is always going to be, always has been, at least so far in my career as well too, always that challenge. You have to be able to balance that out. You have to be able to communicate the story that it's telling. What you said about having that third party is so true. I can't even tell you how many times I've said to other people where I'm like, you tell him that because he will listen to you. Right. He will listen to you versus me, because I've said this and it's not getting to him. Like, the message isn't being received, you know?
Yeah, 100%. On the sales, yes. One of my best salespeople is someone who's very different than me culturally and demographically. And it works well, because when we go into a meeting, we can sort of see like, who do they, it's not about trust, but like, who do they jive with more? Cool. That one. Great. And it, and you can tell they're going to receive it better if it comes from this person. And there's some people who just want to hear it from me. And so being self-aware enough to realize maybe I'm not the right person to deliver this message is skill that took me a long time to develop, and I still could get better at it.
I think we could all get, we're all works in progress is what I think. Now, this question is going to seem a little ironic because we are talking about data-driven, but I do believe that there's almost this level of like gut intuition as well too, when you're looking at these numbers and you're trying to decide, I know that it says this, but I've done it in this way before. Where does intuition play for you when it comes to making decisions based on strategy when you're looking at the numbers? Does it come into play at all? Give me a percentage breakdown. 70-30?
Rarely. Rarely. For me, intuition is about the creative scoping up front about how we want to approach. And that helps if you understand the brand. It helps if you have a cultural affinity. But once we're in market, I'm trying to be very data. I'm trying to have like all the hunches out of the equation. Uh-huh. Like I guess you have a different opinion than that. You're willing to follow a hunch more, which is totally cool.
No, I think that I think the way that you've articulated it in regards to that kind of intuition coming from the creative makes the most sense. Like, numbers are going to be numbers, but you're right. There's a way that you can tweak the message that's being received. And then the data is going to tell you if the message isn't being received. So there's usually things that you can do on the front end from that. I'm just always really curious as to like, if intuition is part of it for people, and if so, at what stage do they?
Oh, it is for clients. Yeah. It is for clients. So, I mean, we work with like global multinational clients, and we work with, I got a phone call this morning at 9 a.m. Eastern with a guy that owns a boat dealership in Georgia. And I hope he hires us. He's such a cool dude. And I really like talking to him. That's different than talking to Italy, who has locations all across the world. It's a different thing. Casio G-Shock watches we work with. It's a different thing. And I enjoy both of them. What in the middle, right? There's generally in my company, generally, $20 million brands don't walk up to us. It's happened. It happens.
Yeah.
It's much more common at my company that a $500,000 or $1 million company will come to us. And if we're lucky enough to be part of working with them over years and it all works, maybe we'll take them to 20 million. So we're along that journey, right? That's sort of who we are as an agency. Again, we work with Shiseido and we work with Casio, but really most of our clients are like founder-led, VC-backed on the DTC yeah. side companies. And they'll say, some of the smaller ones, the clients will be very interested in their intuition. And they'll say, if any of my clients are listening to this, do you think this is about you? It's not. It's about a group of you. And I'm not even being negative. Like I get it. But it's we can't do that ad because it's not on brand. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have a brand guidebook? No. Okay. Do you have a style guide? No. Okay. So how do you define the brand? Well, it's a feeling. Okay. I understand that. You get to do that. You're selling 2 units a day. And when we had these ads on, you sold 10 units a day. Which of those do you prefer? And then there's a conversation around like, well, I think the 2 units a day is better because they get our brand better. And so I find that's more on the client side, the hunches and the intuition. I'll listen to that. Like they're the boss. I'll give them my contrary opinion, but then they get to decide if we're going to follow that path or not. So sometimes they're right, by the way. Like they know their brand better than I do. They dreamed it up. So they understand it.
Yeah, no one knows their business more like they, you know, like an owner of a business for sure, to be able to just kind of make those decisions. What do you find, if anything, are kind of common pitfalls other people in marketing fall into when they are looking at data? And like, how would one overcome those pitfalls? Or is there anything common that you see that
people consider? Yeah, no, there definitely is. I want to go back though. I do know some clients' businesses better than they do, but not if they're a founder-led company that's run by 3 people that went to college together and have run for 10 years. Like those companies, they know it better than I do. But there are companies that we work with that are corporate, that are like $100 million companies that were just sold by from a VC firm to another, and they've got an operator in, and I've worked with them in the background, not full time.
I've worked
with them for 7 years, and I understand the business better than them, and that's not always well received when there's an operator from VC firm in there. But so that I just want to put that in there. But the what are the pitfalls? The pitfalls to me are related to your first question about tweaking marketing strategies, and so it's to focus on ROI. And they're not looking at aggregated data, and they're not seeing the forest through the trees, which may be legitimate. It may be that their bonus depends on ROI numbers, and I don't get to decide that for them. But the thing for me is, and I talk about this a lot, the thing for me is I need to, for me, the biggest thing that goes back to like advice for people, the clients that grow the fastest have a few things in common, and one of them is they've got very clear goals. Like more is not a goal. A goal is I want to increase sales by 10% a quarter, or I want to move 100,000 units by this date, or I want to get this many impressions in market for this campaign. Like those are goals. A lot of clients have goals, and more specifically, most clients don't have new customer goals. Almost all of our clients, not all of them, have revenue targets by month going forward 12 months. Some of them don't. Some of them are on the fly, and that's cool. We love those people. I'm not sure the boat guy who I want to hire me that I talked to this morning will have those. And I love those clients. I do. But most people have 12-month revenue goals. Very few people have new customer goals by month. And there's a big distinction there. Because if you're not thinking with perspicacity and diligence about how many new customers you need and what they're worth to you, you're going to be focused instead on revenue, which is going to, in general, lead to a short-term focus on profitability, which is, in general, going to focus on returning customers. And the way I talk about that is, if Edward Sexton's listening, Dominic, I'm not talking about you. I'm using you as an example. if the average customer at Edward Sexton, a client of ours in London in Savile Row, buys 2 suits, that's not their number. I'm not giving anything away. If the average customer buys 2 suits for them over the course, some people buy 20, some people buy 1. The average number is 2. An existing customer that we remarket to has by definition, by average, 1 more suit to buy. And that suit's good and they should buy it. But a brand new customer has two suits to buy by definition and is therefore worth twice as much as the existing customer you're going to resell to. That the math breaks down a little bit because you will find people that, again, buy 10 suits. But that is the math overall. And again, I'm not talking about the client specifically. I'm using it as an example because I'm wearing one of their new products today to try it out. It's on my mind. But so drilling home to clients that the goal, revenue goals are great. You need them. Also, how many of them are going to come from new customers and where are you going to get them? Are they going to come all from Google? Congratulations, that's going to be really expensive. What's your financing? Are they going to come from Google and Meta, and you're willing to tolerate a different cost per lead, cost per order, CAC, efficiency metric on Meta, because you know it fuels things later on because you've got the data? Even better. Yeah. Are you also doing influencer? Are you doing PR? What's your organic strategy? Where are your customers going to come from? And I think about that for myself in a B2B capacity. Our goal is to grow 33% this year. We know what our average client churn ratio is. So if we're going to start here, we know that on average, each year, we're going to lose this many. And so now we need to get back here. And then up here to 33%, we know what our close ratio is. We know how many people we have to talk to each month. And we have to talk to about 20 new prospects each month. That's not my business's number, but it's pretty close. And we know where we're going to get them from. We have a plan. We're going to get this many from referrals. We're going to get this many from trade shows. We're going to get this many from advertising. We're going to get this many from people we know. Like, and you need to have that plan. So if there's one piece of data that I think are most important for people, and data set that I think the industry as a whole could do better at, it's, and not schools, because they always have to get new customers, it's how many new customers do you need to drive your revenue? I almost think that's more important than top line revenue targets.
Well, it all feeds into your revenue. That's really what it is, right? And you got to look at it from a completely different way. And you know, what it tells me from a marketing perspective is where am I going to burn my calories, right? Like, am I so focused on like these Google ads and this awareness that I'm ignoring my customers, not focused at all on customer marketing? And when you look at the numbers, that's where I should be investing, because they repeat business so much. And they're a big portion of it. So I think that's a great way to articulate it and tie it back to revenue, ironically, like, but not make revenue be the only thing that you are accountable. Like, it is, that will happen. It is almost, you know, collateral damage. Not damage. That sounds,
I'll tell you, it won't happen if you don't get new customers. But your analogy, your analogy for calories is a really good one. I might steal that from you. It's really good. You can eat less, you can walk more, you can lift weights, but you got to decide somehow how you're going to get those calories down below your resting metabolic rate if you want to lose weight. There's no way around it. Like, decide. That's a good analogy. I might steal that from you. I'll give you credit if I do.
Oh, you don't have to. I will steal all of yours. That's why I have the podcast. I have one final question for you. And that is, if you knew then what you know now, what is the marketing or non-marketing advice that you would give to yourself? Drop us some wisdom.
You know, my kid's going to go to college soon, and I get very like cats in the cradle and the silver spoon about this. I like my job. I'm committed to it. I really love my job. I work at least 60 hours a week, usually over 6 or 7 days a week, and I have freedom, and I'm lucky to have the freedom to do that. And like, I can get the work done on Sunday if I want to miss my kids, if I want to miss some work to go to a kid's ball game. I do wish that I'd spent more time at dinner with my kid over the last 16 years. And I know it's like a very soppy thing to say, but it's true that over the last 16 or 17 years, I think about him going to college next year. I wish I'd done that. And a lot of people have given me that advice over the years. Like, hey, dude, and I'm not saying like, I really like my job. So I'm not like, you hear people that say like, no career is worth it. The only thing important is downtime. Like, I'm not saying that at all. Or like, the life work balance is key. Like, I don't think that's true at all. Like, I'm totally motivated by my job. I love my job, but I do wish that I'd been more flexible in it to spend more time with my kid. And my wife's great too, but I see her after he goes to bed, to spend more time with my kid as I think about him departing us to go to college. I'm sure that's a thing a lot of people with kids going into the senior year of high school think to themselves. That's my non-marketing advice.
I love that non-marketing advice. As a mom of two boys who are, I'm an empty nester at this point. My youngest is going to start his junior year in college. And it's true. You miss that. You miss the noise. Like, he's back for the summer. As annoying as it was for him to be cooking at like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night when he's home, I'm like, ah, I love the sound of the stomping.
The stomping. And it's like they want to...
It's stomping because I'm a mom of two boys, right? Like, it's the stomping, it's the conversations. And now, like, I've done this thing where...
Bro.
Exactly. You take these, like, little moments, like, for my youngest, I call it kitchen conversations, because when he'd come out of his cave and he'd go downstairs and he'd get some more food, we'd have long kitchen conversations. It's the random conversations that, like, you don't know are happening at the time, where they update you on life. So, and I like that. I think that one of the things that I really like that you said is that you love your job and you're committed to your job. I think that our kids need to see that as well too, but they also need to see that balance of like also choosing them, because, you know, your work ethic is something that they're going to take into their adulthood as well too. Yeah. So I think you've done a good job. I don't know your kids, but
I don't know if he would agree. I like to think I have two, and I do think that a work ethic is important. I do. And I think about my own father, and shouldn't get into the air, so I won't. But yeah, he was always home for dinner. Let's say that, which I wish I'd done a little more of that.
Well, that's, I think, sound advice, non-marketing, and I'll take it, a great way to just kind of wrap up the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on here and just sharing everything that you did.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode just as much as I did. I am ready to go over our key takeaways. Key takeaway number one, success depends on who you're trying to reach. Now, during the podcast, Brooke said you're going to be so efficient with your dollars that you're going to efficient yourself right out of business. And while it sounds comical, there is a lot of truth to it. Businesses are all about the bottom line, as they should be. It's a business. The ROI of what you're doing. It's easy to default to what shows kind of the best metrics to show success on paper to define that. But if those metrics are only tied to existing customers, for example, and not the total addressable market, how successful are we really? This is the trap. But if you aren't bringing in new customers, are you even really growing? Insert tree in the forest falling analogy here. If you put all of your eggs in one basket of people you're trying to reach, which in this example is customers versus net new, then eventually you're gonna run out of people. This is where strategic segmentation comes in. Data isn't one size fits all. As marketers, we need to define different KPIs for new customers versus existing ones, or one industry sector over the other. We really need to define the different KPIs for each segment we're going after, which means that not every campaign should be judged by its efficiency, believe it or not. Some should be judged by their potential. What are you trying to achieve with that? And what are the metrics that align with that? Whether you're looking at net new prospects versus customers, or if you want to expand markets. So when we're defining success, make sure we define who we're trying to reach to begin with. Key takeaway number two, tell a nonfiction story with your data. Now, if data tells a story, then marketers, we're the narrators. Here's the thing though, your story has to be true and it has to be told in a language that your audience understands. You need the data to speak to the CEO, the VP, the director, and the intern. They all have to understand it, which isn't easy, but it's so vital. A great example shared was how Brooke tackled this with one of his clients. The Meta ads had a higher cost per lead than the Google ads. The CFO immediately flagged it as a problem, right? Numbers to numbers. But Brooke and his team, including a Columbia statistics professor, told a much broader story. The Meta ads were driving a lift in organic traffic and increasing the performance in Google. It's not fiction. It's fact. It's the whole picture. but don't expect them to make the connections that you know like the back of your hand. As marketers, our job isn't just to analyze the data, it's to communicate the data and tell the story. And sometimes that means repeating yourself, as Brooke noted, and honestly was his best advice on that matter. Repeat, repeat, oh yeah, and then repeat. And sometimes that means tailoring your message to match the mindset of your stakeholder. But the principle is the same. Don't just report the metric, explain its meaning. I have personally found that when you align your data story to business outcomes, not just campaign metrics, that's where trust is built. And that trust is that bridge between marketing and the rest of the business. I think it really also positions you to not just execute, but to be creative and strategic, which in my opinion is kind of the fun part of marketing. Now, key takeaway number three, the halo effect is real. So measure like it. One of the most compelling parts of this conversation was really when we talked about the halo effect in marketing. And in his example, he had broken it down to spend more on Meta, spend more on Meta, get more organic, spend more on Meta, do better on Google. That's not a gut feeling. That's a data-backed insight confirmed by a statistician. And while we don't all have one of those guys on hand, wouldn't that be great? It remains a fact that influence plays a part in the success of a business. The message here is very simple. Not all impact is direct, and meaning like this one-to-one. And if you're only measuring the direct responses, you're undervaluing the real contribution of brand awareness, creative deployment, and all of your top of funnel efforts. In Brooke's world, performance and brand aren't at odds. They're collaborators. This is a trap I see far too often. Teams kill an ad that didn't convert in platform without realizing it made their email click-through rates spike or improved branded search 2 weeks later. Good marketing doesn't just make people buy, it makes people think, it makes people search and remember. That's the halo. And it's where many marketers stop measuring, which means they stop learning. So if you're making channel by channel decisions based only on platform metrics, consider this approach. Add time, add layers, add curiosity, because your marketing is talking to itself. Are you listening? A special thank you to my podcast editor, Johnny Ike. And if you walked away with an insight, drop us a review. It really does help others find the podcast. And thanks to you for spending your time with me today. Until next time, may the conversation flow, the laughter linger, and the outlook remain optimistic but grounded in reality. This is Katya, signing off.